Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, cfuv.uvic.ca around the world on the internet. While media memory being short, the name Michael Brown Jr. may elicit no more than a blank look from most people, but last month, reaction to his untimely death threatened to burn the town of Ferguson, Missouri to the ground. At least that's the way the story was told by the corporate media and repeated by its state-sponsored Canadian correlative, the CBC. Brown was, of course, the black teenager shot dead in a hail of bullets fired by a policeman for the crime of jaywalking, sparking angry community protests. David Rovics is an inveterate American activist, singer-songwriter in the tradition of Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. David has played at demos too numerous to count for myriad issues, both universal and circumstantial. From his start busking Boston's subway to traveling across America and the broader world, he's earned his sobriquet as professional flat-picking rabble-rouser honestly. Rovics was in Ferguson last month, checking out the neighborhood where Michael was killed and attending his funeral. He reported on the great societal divide in an essay titled Ferguson Reflections, published at his website davidrovics.com, where you can also find his catalog of more than 200 tunes available for download. David Rovics in the first half. And the tenuous Ukraine ceasefire is holding. This week, the two sides continued negotiations for a longer-lasting peace accord, while civilians displaced by the fighting returned home to pick up the pieces and mourn the dead. Roger Annis is a Vancouver-based peace and social justice activist and editor of the Canada-Haiti Action Network website, CanadaHaitiAction.ca. His writing can also be found at rabble.ca and at his site, A Socialist in Canada. Roger is recently returned from Crimea, from where he filed reports on deteriorating living conditions for the people beneath the bombs of the Kiev-based coup regime. Roger Annis and Ending the War Against the Civilians of Eastern Ukraine in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher emeritus and CFUV radio broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us up to speed with some of the good things going on in and around our city and beyond there too. But first, seeing ourselves reflected in Ferguson. Stick around. Well, as often happens in live broadcasting, things don't go exactly as according to plan, and I can't seem to get a hold of David. I'm hoping that he'll get a hold of me in due course, but in the meantime, what I'll do is I'll play a backup piece. Now, I've been trying to do this. I've had spotty success rates here these last few weeks, but they've always cleared themselves up, and I've tried several times to play this audio of this now infamous demo, Interruptus, one of the Gaza demos here in Victoria, where these Christian Zionists and some Israeli tourists barged into the demo to have their peace, and so I interviewed a couple of them. One of the Christian Zionists from Victoria, and one of the Israeli tourists that happened to pass by this demo. This was during the bombing of Gaza on August 9th. So I'm going to play this and hope that you don't get to hear it all, because that means David would have got a hold of me. But here goes. The obvious evidence is there's 2,000 Palestinians killed in this latest round.
You know something? Have you seen some of the videos where they're carrying children from the morgue and putting them in front of the schools to make it look like that they were just killed? Or have you seen the places where they have body bags on them, and then all of a sudden the kids begin to laugh? They're under the bags, and then they lift up because they're tickling. You know, you can't believe propaganda. And when they want to do only one thing, and the only thing that I have ever seen Hamas do, or the Muslim Brotherhood, is kill the Jew, kill the Jew, kill the Jew. Why?
Have you seen the video of the bombed out buildings and stuff?
Listen, if you were to be living in a place where you are bombed over 2,000 times in less than a year, and you don't retaliate, all you have used is your dome, tell me What will you do when you find out that there are massive amount of tunnels that are getting ready for a huge besiege to take you over? What would you do?
So you agree the Palestinians that have been bombed more than 2,000 times in the last month?
No, it's not the Palestinians bombed. It's the Gaza people bombing Israel over 2,000 times.
So it's the Palestinian Air Force that is bombing Israel?
Who just broke the last piece? It was not Israel that bombed first. It was Hamas that went and started it again. Third time they have broken the peace every time. Why? If what they want is peace, why do you start the bombing again?
Well, again,
why do you spend millions and millions of dollars on tunnels
to do
only one thing?
I disagree with your premise again. I'm curious to know where your information is coming from other than the internet.
Well, we have friends in Israel.
Right?
Yes.
And they told you that Hamas broke
the... There are some that are here right now.
They said that Hamas broke the ceasefire?
Well, I don't even have to do that. I just have to go to the news channel to know that they broke the ceasefire.
Which news channel?
CNN was the first one. Fox News was another one.
Because you're aware that the Hamas... the truce for 19 months, Hamas had maintained the ceasefire.
They have never maintained the ceasefire. They have never.
Okay, so I can see that we're not going to agree, but
yeah.
I'll just finally ask you, though, Jesus, the Prince of Peace, who would Jesus bomb?
You know, he stands for righteousness sake. He's not doing the bombing. It's man that's doing the bombing.
No, I mean, who would Jesus bomb?
I don't think he would bomb anyone. He wouldn't die.
Now we agree.
But understand something. Yeah. He died on the cross to make a man's choice of free will. And it is man's free will if he bombs, not God's. Okay?
I've seen you in the markets, I've seen you in the streets, and at your political conventions. Talking of your crusade, talking of your nation, and other things too terrible to mention. And you proclaim your Christianity, you proclaim your love of God, you talk of apple pie and mom. I've just got one question and I want an answer, tell me, who would Jesus bomb? Jesus would bomb the Syrians, 'cause they're not Jews like him. Maybe Jesus would bomb the Afghans on some kind of vengeful whim. Maybe Jesus would drive an M1 tank and he would shoot Saddam. Who would Jesus bomb? I've seen you on the TV and on the battleships. I've seen you in the house upon the hill. And I've heard you talking about making the world safer and about all the men you have to kill. And you speak so glibly about your civilization and how you have the moral higher ground. While halfway around the world, your explosives smash the buildings. If you could only hear the sound. But maybe Jesus would sell landmines and turn on his electric chair. Maybe Jesus would show no compassion for his enemies in the lands way over there. Maybe Jesus would have flown the planes that killed the kids in Vietnam. Who would Jesus bomb? With confidence as you praise the Lord and you talk about this God you know so well. You talk of Armageddon and your final victory when all the evil forces go to hell. Well, you'd best hope you've chosen wisely on the right side of the Lord, and when you die, your conscience it is clear. You'd best hope your atom bombs are better than the sword at the time that your reckoning is here. Jesus would send gunships into Bethlehem or jets to raise the towns of Timorese I don't think Jesus would lend money to dictators or drive those SUVs. I don't think Jesus would ever have dropped a single ounce of napalm. Who would Jesus bomb? Who would Jesus bomb? Who would Jesus bomb?
Yeah, and that's David Rovick's. I guess I just couldn't get him. There must be some mix-up about the time or whatever. Maybe he thinks the show is still Mondays, or I don't know. Anyone that's listened to this show before knows that we aired on Monday at 5 p.m. for years and years and years. But now we're here at Wednesdays at 1, between 1 and 2, every Wednesday, hopefully, and bringing you that well-thought-out and executed live radio as you've become so used to it. What I'll do now is I'll play a little bit now. I'll continue on with more. Now, that was, of course, the Christian Zionist who had crashed the Gaza rally. And she was crazy. She was totally insane and really aggressive. I mean, I don't know if you could get it with the look here, you, but with a pointy finger, this little old lady, inflated with the power of the Lord. It looked like she was going to just go go after me there for a second. But before passing on to my next little chit-chat with an actual Israeli tourist that was here, I'll remind you, you're listening to CFUV, broadcast at CFUV 101.9 FM from the University of Victoria, right here in the basement of the sub-building, and at cfuv.uvic.ca on the interweb. You know, you can like us on Facebook if you go to facebook.com/CFUV101.9, or you can follow us on Twitter at CFUV and at CFUV DJ. So these are all our various communication attempts there. My website too, I have two websites, a Guerrilla Radio blog.blogspot.ca and pacificfreepress.com. And today, one of the people who helped get the website going, the Pacific Free Press website at least, was Chris Floyd. And there's a long story behind that, but he's a writer based in London, or just outside of London. He's American, though. And he passed on a piece today from his website, Empire Burlesque. And it was basically just something he took off the London Review of Books, something by a guy named Omar Hamilton. And what Chris says is that Omar Hamilton outlines the many confidence-building efforts being undertaken by Israel to construct a just and lasting peace in the Holy Land following the recent spat in Gaza. Now, below is Hamilton's piece in full, but that's with a link. But do see all the links to detailing the flowers of peace that Israel is planting among its Palestinian brothers and sisters. A little note of sarcasm there on Chris's part, but there's a good reason for that. And this is what Omar writes. On 26 August, a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas was agreed, bringing a fragile end to a war that killed 2,150 Palestinians, mostly civilians, and 73 Israelis, mostly soldiers. Since then, Hamas has not fired a single rocket, attacked an Israeli target, or done anything to break the terms of the ceasefire. Israel has done the following. 1. Annexed another 1,500 acres of West Bank land. 2. Seized $56 million of PA, that's the Palestinian Authority, tax revenue. 3. Not lifted the illegal blockade as required by the ceasefire. 4. Broken the ceasefire by firing at fishermen on 4 separate occasions. 5. Detained 6 fishermen. 6. Killed a 22-year-old Issa al-Qatari a week before his wedding. 7. Killed 16-year-old Mohammed Asinokrat with a rubber bullet to the head. 8. Tortured a prisoner to the point of hospitalization. 9. Refused 13 members of the European Parliament entry into Gaza. 10. Detained at least 127 people across the West Bank, including a 7-year-old boy in Hebron and 2 children, aged 7 and 8, taken from the courtyard of their house in Silwad and tear gassed their mother. 11. Continued to hold 33 members of the Palestinian Legislative Council in prison. 12. Continued to hold 500 prisoners in administrative detention without charge or trial. 13. Destroyed Bedouin homes in Khan al-Ahmar near Jerusalem, leaving 14 people homeless, and unveiled a plan to forcibly move thousands of Bedouin away from Jerusalem into 2 purpose-built townships. 14, destroyed a dairy factory in Hebron whose profits supported an orphanage. 15, destroyed a family home in Silwan, making 5 children homeless. 16, destroyed a house in Jerusalem where aid supplies en route to Gaza were being stored. 17, destroyed a well near Hebron. 18, set fire to an olive grove near Hebron. 19, raided a health center and nursery school in Nablus, causing extensive damage. 20, destroyed a swath of farmland in Rafah by driving tanks over it. 21, ordered the dismantling of a small monument in Jerusalem to Muhammad Abu Qader, murdered in July by an Israeli lynch mob. 22, continued building a vast tunnel network under Jerusalem. 23, stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound with a group of far-right settlers. 24, assisted hundreds of settlers in storming Joseph's tomb in Nablus. 25, prevented students from entering Al-Quds University, firing stun grenades and rubber bullets at those who tried to go in. And 26, earned unknown millions on reconstruction materials for Gaza, where 100,000 people need their destroyed homes rebuilt. The total bill estimated is $7.8 billion. So those are just a few of the ways that Israel keeps the peace and observes the ceasefire. And as my mad Christian friend was saying, it's always Hamas who does that. It's very self-same thing. Proved comically wrong in this instance, although it's not as funny as it might be, had the consequences not been so serious. So now what I'll do is I'll go back to that little interview with some of the Israeli tourists that showed up as well.
You have to understand, it is man choosing to do what he does. It is not God. We've allowed that free will. And that free will is what the destruction has become. I love the Palestinians. I've had friends that have been Muslims, that have converted, and have said, never ever have I understood what it meant to know I have salvation. I didn't have to martyr myself to be saved. Pretty good. You can know it now. You don't have to wait. And Yeshua is the answer. He truly is. Peace will never come as long as man follows his heart.
Well, thanks for talking.
Unless he follows God's.
Well, thank you.
All right, you're
welcome. It's a fiery talk by Randy. And there's some excitement here where a group of what I'm presuming to be Israeli tourists are here attacking and making quite a row. I'll try to listen to some of this and see. Hey, Bobby. See if I can find any sense. Here's the rabble here. Seems to be quite a violent reaction by some of these tourists. And music. Are you guys from Israel? You're visiting Canada, and have you visited other places and seen similar demonstrations against what is happening?
In the Alaska, we didn't see.
This is the first time you've seen it?
Here, yes.
Are you worried about the image Israel is getting because of this campaign?
No, we're Israelis. We're very proud, and we know what we suffer. We know what we suffer. Nobody looks at what we suffer and how we are bombarded every day, and kids don't go out because they're afraid.
How are you suffering in Israel?
Because nobody goes out. We're standing all the time in shelters because we are bombarded every day, every night. What's talking about only Palestine? It's talking about the kids from Israel that are the same kids. Nobody pays attention to those kids. Nobody pays attention to people who are losing kids and soldiers and everybody because they're bombarding every place, every house. Nobody can live like that.
That 63 soldiers, I believe, have been killed and 3 civilians in Israel. Is that right?
That's right. That's quite as far as we know when we left. Now we're here, we don't know every time what's going on, but a lot is going on every time. You can't do this. It's unjust.
Which the demonstration is unjust?
It's unjust because it doesn't show the both sides. It shows only one side. And when you look only one side, you see only half of the planet, not the other half of it.
Do you know how many Palestinians have been killed?
Yes, we know. Yes, we know. We're very sorry. Everybody is sorry. Nobody wants people to be killed. But not from only one side. From both sides. So you can't take sides only to look at one side of the problem. There is another side.
Why do you insist that it's one-sided when most of the American media is very much supportive and the Canadian government is very much supportive of Israel?
Very good, because nobody supports this side. Because a lot of people in the globe see only what they are killed in Gaza. Nobody.
But most governments and media in the West support Israel, and they.
No, not most governments. There are a few governments and a lot that doesn't support. Take Turkey doesn't support. Take Russia doesn't support. It's part of the globe.
But the Western countries of Europe and America.
The part of them say, okay, let's solve the problem, but doesn't anybody does anything? So you have to take them to look at the problem in a more complex way, not in one way. People are killed. People are killed on both sides, not on one side. Nobody wants people to be killed on any side. You have to get a fair look at both sides and to see how people live in both sides. And
well, if we looked at pictures of Tel Aviv and Gaza, it would be a very different picture.
Of course, but nobody looks at the people who are in every half an hour has to go into shelter and not live and not make a living and not go to school and not do anything. That's a kind of to live in jail. That are not killed as much, that's not a problem. They're not living in jail.
So do you believe Mr. Netanyahu and his government will sue for peace because of the privations that the Israeli citizenry are going through during this operation?
I'm a citizen of the country. I'm not a prime minister. I'll do his job, I'll do my job. But the world has to see not only the misery of people who are killed, but the misery of people who are living like in prison. Nobody wants to live like in prison. I want to see one Canadian living like ours.
Gaza has been described as a prison many times.
Gaza has been destroyed not because Israel is destroyed, but the Hamas destroyed it. They destroyed it by not letting the people live.
But...
Yeah, welcome back to Grill Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else. Joining us now, as oft times she does, is Victoria Street News publisher emeritus and CFUV radio broadcaster in her own right, Janine Bancroft. Welcome back, Janine.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Nice to be here again.
Well, and I have to thank you. I have to thank you for covering for me as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was fun. Radio is fun. And you know what? There's a whole whack of activities happening. I guess now that the students are back, you know, and summer is technically sort of winding to an end, people are putting on their winter programming for the activists. So we've got tonight the Indigenous Solidarity Working Group, which is a planning meeting and fundraiser to reclaim... pardon my pronunciation, La Walnu Mountain, and this is on in the Coast Salish near here, near Salt Spring. It's Grace Islet. It's a First Nations cemetery, may have heard of it, Chris,
and a private
homeowner has been granted a permit to build a luxury home directly on top of the graves. And, of course, this is going to spark many peaceful protests, which have been happening all summer. If people want to learn more about it, it's tonight at the Grad Lounge, 7 o'clock. So, not a good idea to build on top of graves.
Well,
right?
To be fair to the owner, now he went through, the provincial government has an authority that assesses these things, and they've got anthropologists and so forth that say it's okay. And he had gone through, the house owner or the builders had gone through this process, And then there was this one area that was identified, and now just maybe it was an honest mistake, but they encroached on a certain area, and now they're, you know, now they're getting intransigent about the whole thing, and it's getting kind of ugly.
Well, you know, I think it's really important to acknowledge Indigenous rights, and yeah, if the government isn't going to do that, then it's up to the people to bring that to people's attention and hope that they'll make the right decision, right?
Yeah, it's not a good way to go, that's for sure. And I'm not even sure the exact details, if they laid foundations over a certain area or if, you know, or what, but it's going, they're fighting and they're not talking with each other, so.
Yeah, well, yeah, so if it's, I think tonight this is a good place to learn about it at the Grad Lounge at 7 o'clock. And then also tonight, if people are staying home, there is a webinar organized by Amnesty International to do with the Stolen Sisters, you know, the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in Canada. It's the 10th anniversary of Amnesty's report on the campaign on violence against Indigenous women. And so they're asking if people want to get together online and learn and talk about it. And their space is limited, though, so if you want to register, go to amnesty.ca and then go to the events tab and find that information there. And then Thursday, there's a whole whack of activities as well. Thursday, Salmon Confidential is showing, and this is Alexandra Morton's research. You've seen this film, right?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, and I've got it up at my website, at both websites, so you can watch it at your leisure.
Oh, okay, there you go. If you want to watch it with other people and then talk about it, it's tomorrow night at the Douglas BCGU Hall, 2994 Douglas, 7 o'clock. It's organized by the Victoria Friends of Cuba. This is their social justice film night that happens on the 3rd Thursday of every month. So this is to do with the farmed fish and what's happening to the wild fish as a result. And she's done tremendous research into this, and this is a very well-documented analysis of all of that, as I understand it. Also, tomorrow night, urban forests. If you want to learn more about urban forests and how to be a good steward of them, we are having fewer and fewer urban forests as the buildings go up. But what remains, you know, if we want to protect it and make sure that it can survive in isolation from the rest of the forest, is tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at UVic McLaurin Building Room D116. It's $3, and it's organized by the Native Plant Study Group to listen to Everett Peterson, who has been a steward of the forest surrounding Goward House on Arbutus Road over by the university for more than 10 years. So he's had a good look at how the forests react to various things and wants to share that information. And then remember when you were in your other time slot there and we were talking about the Stone Soup event for our Eco Village fundraiser,
right?
And then they had to delay that. So that's happening this tomorrow as well.
Soup, and what a great concept. The stone soup thing is that one guy says, okay, I'm going to make some stone soup, and you're welcome to come along and add whatever you want to it. And then a bunch of people come, and of course, he throws the stone in the water, and then everyone else then makes a nice soup out of it after all.
Makes a nice soup. I know there's a whole story of that, and there's a whole story of our Eco Village. It's a fantastic place, from what I understand, being there. Sadly, Brandy Gallagher, one of the founders and the executor, director is battling cancer, and so they're wanting to do a fundraiser. My understanding is that she's living in this beautiful paradise, but she's dealing with all this stress of possibly losing her beautiful, this vision that she's created, not just for her but for the whole community. So, you know, it would lighten her load to know that there's at least funding to keep the place going for a little while. So tomorrow at the Oddfellows Hall, which is worth a visit just in itself, 1316 Douglas Street, a very interesting building.
Yeah, it's
cool. And then Friday and Saturday, the One Wave Festival. So this is the Pacific People's Partnership, the UVic Center for Asia Pacific Initiatives, and Puppets for Peace. They got all kinds of activities going on. I'm just going to send people to the website, pacificpeoplespartnership.org. It's happening at Centennial Square. I would follow the links to Facebook. They've got all kinds of events going on in different locations at the university. They're having a Puppets for Peace parade on Sunday at 1, and then an event at the Government House at 2. So, yeah, it just sounds like a really fun weekend to learn more about the Pacific peoples and their partnership and get involved, maybe. And then, also, on Saturday, big rally. You know, they're having this big rally in New York to do with the climate. And so the local folks are organizing a rally at the Peace Arch Park. And, you know, the Peace Arch Park, you can go from both sides of the borders and kind of mingle without actually having to show any passports or anything, which is kind of cool. And so there's buses and carpooling being organized from Vancouver and Seattle, and people are going to gather at 1 till 3 on Saturday. So I would check out the Facebook group there. It's just called International Rally Climate Change Knows No Borders. And then that's kind of it for this week, Chris. I'm sure there's more. But
well, there is more, actually. And I've got one from our mutual friend, Christina Niklik, who, with Gaia College and Royal Roads University, she will be presenting information session tonight at 6:30 at Royal Roads, which is 2005 Souk Road, you know, the big castle out there. And it's for the certificate course in ecological landscape design. Learn to draw beautiful, functional, and ecologically sound landscapes from scratch from the people who brought you the Organic Master Gardener course. The start date is October 4, 2014. Free information session is tonight, 6:30 p.m., September 17th. At Royal Roads University, 2005 Souk Road, Victoria, or you can get details at www.gaiacollege.ca or phone 391-2600, extension 4801. There you go. So if you want to learn to be more ecological in your garden, check that out at Royal Roads tonight, 6:30 p.m.
There we go.
Okay.
Lots to do.
There's always something to do, especially at this time of year when people are starting to move kind of indoors, even though the weather is still rather summery out there. But your program, we hope they're indoors for Janine, alternating every Thursday at 11 a.m. right here at CFUV, is The Winds of Change, and it alternates with Mehdi Najjari's Hidden News. And this week is Mehdi's turn, I believe.
This is Mehdi's week, yep. Always a good show.
Well, we'll tune in for that, and always look out for the megaphone, the street paper that filled the vacuum left by your own Victoria Street News.
Yeah, we invited them into the space, and it's a fantastic little magazine, so I think people are supporting it, from what I understand, from the vendors. They seem happy.
So. Yeah, so look at your vendors. There's, a dozen or so in and around Victoria and environs. All right, Janine, well, thanks a lot. If that's it, we'll talk to you the next time, eh?
Alrighty, thanks, Chris.
All right, then, bye-bye. Now, what I'm going to do is I'll play a bit of, and again, it's too bad I couldn't hook it up with David Rovics, but he'll be here in spirit, or at least in vinyl, in any case, and I'll come back, hopefully, with Roger Annis.
Rodney Coronado was arrested for a speech that he gave one evening by the San Diego Beat. He stated his opinions, they sounded just like mine. Now they want to put him behind bars till 2029. The prosecutor said the problem was a speech it showed intent. I couldn't figure out exactly what that meant. You can't describe an action, say you thought that it was swell. What'll happen when we sing this? Who the heck can tell? But we don't like the condo and we're gonna burn it down. Corporate terrorists drive them out of town. We'll bring a lot of gasoline, burn on the floor, light a match, say a prayer, and run right out the door, burn it down. This is your part, by the way. When I say burn it down, you say burn it down. That's complex, but we can do it. I'll call and respond, right? Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
We're going to burn it down. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Well, by folk club standards, that was pretty good, but you know, the enthusiasm is a bit lacking, so you know, we can work on that though.
If you just sang that chorus, then you just broke the law. To be an equal terrorist, now you just gotta flap your jaw. And hey, who knows, by the time you have a chance to blink, whether you're a criminal might depend on what you think. We don't like the bulldozer, we're gonna burn it down. Corporate terrorists, drive them out of town. We'll bring a lot of gasoline, pour it on the floor, light a match, say a prayer, and run right out the door. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down. We're going to burn it down. Burn it down. Burn it down. Burn it down.
My sister can sing louder than all the rest of you combined, which she's just proven it. But maybe in the next chorus, you can, there's more of you than there are her, and I think you can do it.
First it came for Rod, maybe next it'll come for you. Let me tell you what I think all of us should do. Sing the song with me, raise your fist and caterwaul. If we fight together, they can't arrest us all. We don't like the Walmart and we're gonna burn it down. Corporate terrorists, drive them out of town. We'll bring a lot of gasoline, pour it on the floor. Light a match, say a prayer and run right out the door. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
We're going to burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Much better. One more time.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
We're going to burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Yeah, and there's David in his glory, singing and doing what he does best, entertaining the folks. Well, a tenuous Ukraine ceasefire is holding. This week, the two sides continued negotiations for a longer-lasting peace accord while civilians displaced by the fighting returned home to pick up the pieces and mourn the dead. Roger Annis is a Vancouver-based peace and social justice activist and editor of the Canada-Haiti Action Network website, CanadaHaitiAction.ca. His writing can also be found at rabble.ca and his site, A Socialist in Canada. Now, Roger is recently returned from Crimea, where he filed reports on deteriorating living conditions for the people living beneath the bombs of the Kiev-based coup regime. Welcome back to the program, Roger.
Well, you're welcome. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Now Roger, as I said, you recently returned from Crimea. Now, how well has Canadian and Western media generally reflected the situation as related to you by the people you encountered there?
Terribly. I think it's on par with what we've come to expect from reporting from Palestine. We've had a very violent and brutal war taking place in eastern Ukraine, particularly in the southeast of Ukraine, for 5 months. But you wouldn't really know that because this war by the governing regime in Kiev is reported as kind of this vague, unexplained conflict going on in that part of the country with no explanation as to who started it, who's responsible for it, who's perpetrating it, and so on. So I think Canadians have been very poorly served by their media in explaining and understanding what's taking place in Ukraine.
Well, Roger, I mean, one of the big parts of, I mean, there's keywords that we keep hearing again and again, you know, Russian-backed rebels or Russian-backed separatists. And it seems listening to the CBC reported on the radio and in television especially, they seem at pains to always emphasize these terms to try to convince everybody that, you know, maybe these people fighting the Kiev regime aren't even Ukrainian at all, that they're some sort of other. But that's not exactly the case, is it? What are these two sides that are fighting, Roger? Can you give us a thumbnail of the participants?
Sure. It's a very long-standing conflict in Ukraine, or you could say between us and the east of the country. Should Ukraine's economy and should its kind of historic and cultural ties be towards Russia, or should something new be created and to make a sharp turn to Western Europe? And the government that came into power in February of this year, I would say by force and violence, has carried out a sharp turn towards Western Europe. That's the big shift that happened in Ukraine, and that was the decision by this government and the economic elite that stands behind it to resolve this long-standing conflict. The people in the east of the country don't accept this. They have both cultural and language ties, but also, very importantly, they have economic ties to Russia. And the east of Ukraine is quite heavily industrialized. It was really, in many ways, the industrial heartland of the former Soviet Union. And so for the government had to carry out this wrenching turn to an economic association with Europe means a severe disruption to the existing trade and economic patterns. And I should add that when we talk about an association with Europe, we're talking about an association with austerity Europe. Mm-hmm. This is no longer the Europe of the 1960s and 70s, where there was some money to go around for social programs and for social democratic type capitalism. This is the kind of the turn that the Kiev government is making is towards the kind of austerity regime that we've seen in Greece and in other countries of southern Europe. So this is the sharp shift that was proposed in February. The people in the East said, "Wait a sec, we don't agree with this. We want to talk about this. We don't. We want a different." Political setup for the country where we can have more say, because Ukraine is a highly centralized country constitutionally and governmentally. But the government of Kiev, backed heavily by NATO, just said, forget it. It's our way or the highway. We're going ahead with this turn to Europe. We're going to dismantle those industries where you work in Eastern Europe, because that's what Europe is going to demand of us, a lowering of trade barriers, a lowering of protective measures that protect and foster industry and agriculture. And so that's the source of the conflict. And Kiev went into eastern Ukraine with its army to say, you know, go back home, shut up, and put up. This is the future of the country. And the people of the East just said, no, we're not accepting that.
It really brings to mind, to memory, for those of us that are a little older, what happened in Yugoslavia, where, you know, it was the last socialist state in Europe, et cetera, and the German government of the day, along with the Anglo-American Axis powers, undermined it and then went in there and of course, wrecked it and imprisoned after vilifying the president there.
Yeah.
Well, Roger, another thing that's often used when talking, especially on the CBC and in the corporate press, they say, well, Crimea was stolen by Russia. Now, you are in Crimea. Are the people of Crimea right now suffering under Mr. Putin's boot, or are they pleased to be out of the fray?
Well, I think the majority of our, you know, when they've looked at what's gone on in the southeast of Ukraine over the last 4 months, you know, they very, very much feel like they dodged a bullet. Grabbed a lifeline to get out of the way of, you know, what was a civil war course by the Kiev government. This was proven in the southeast of the country. So this was a course of civil war for anyone that would oppose the economic association with Europe and all that went with that. So for sure, there's no question that the majority of people in Crimea basically wanted out of the way. And let's recall, Crimea only became an administrative decision of the Soviet Union in 1954. So this is not some big historical rupture that was carried out.
Oh, well, Roger, I think, sorry to interrupt, Roger, I think that it's really important to stress what you just said again. You're breaking up a little bit. Can you remind us again of Crimea's provenance and its relationship to Russia?
That's right. Crimea became part of Ukraine in 1954 through a strictly administrative decision of the former Soviet Union. At the time, it made sense for Ukraine to administer Crimea because the tasks of reconstruction after World War II, remember, we're talking about the battleground of World War II, Crimea and eastern Ukraine, it made sense administratively for Crimea to administer from Ukraine for all the tasks of reconstruction. So this decision in March, this referendum vote in March by the Crimean people to associate with the Russian Federation was really a return to what they had, their political ties really for some centuries. So definitely not the huge rupture with Ukraine as it's presented. And the people of Crimea made this decision because they saw this new neoconservative government come into power in Kiev in February. They saw the fascist parties with which this government has aligned itself, voluntarily aligned itself, and they said, whoa, we want out of here. Now, it is true, of course, that Russia's national interests coincided with this, but there's no question that the majority of the Crimean people wanted association with Russia. But this was the big turning point as far as the attitude of the Western governments. They really had their eyes on Crimea. This is the where the Russia's the naval base of the Russian Federation is located on the Black Sea. So they really had their eyes on this prize, and when it was snatched away from them, the vengeance was very strong. And we're seeing still today, we're seeing the vengeance by the NATO powers and by Ukraine itself being played out over, you know, their loss. I put in quotation marks their loss of Ukraine. There, the audacity of the Crimean people to vote as they did and to choose to leave Ukraine is something that the big powers just won't they won't forgive the Crimean people for that. And so Crimea today, for example, is living under economic sanctions. But you know what? Life goes on, and there's no question the majority of people look north at Ukraine and say, thank God we're not going through that kind of civil war today.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio here on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. We also stream at cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet, and we're on Facebook, CFUV 101.9, predictably enough. I'm speaking tonight with Roger Annis. Roger is just returned, as we're discussing, from, or just recently returned from Crimea. He's a Vancouver-based peace and social justice activist and the editor of the Canada-Haiti Action Network website, CanadaHaitiAction.ca. You can also find Roger's writing at Ravel.ca and at his website, A Socialist in Canada. Well, yeah, as you mentioned, the sanctions and the economic punishments being meted out to Russia and Crimea as well. The president, the coup president, this is oligarch, the billionaire Petro Poroshenko, is in Canada. He's actually in the parliament today addressing the House, and announced shortly after that that he and Stephen Harper have agreed to talk about a free trade agreement between this I'm not even sure what to call the Kiev government. It's been recognized by Canada, as Canada recognized other coup governments like in Honduras and Haiti. What do we make of the treatment that Poroshenko is receiving by our government, Roger?
Well, this is a government who's, as I mentioned earlier, came into power in February, and its interests coincide very closely with Western Europe and North America. They want a sharp turn to austerity. They want to at least come under the military umbrella of NATO, if not eventually join NATO, which is an extremely provocative act towards Russia, to be enticing a country right on Russia's border to be joining this NATO military alliance, which, let's recall, its raison d'etre is threats and hostility against first the Soviet Union and now Russia. This is, you know, just a completely unacceptable act. I think the main thing that we'll see coming out of President Poroshenko's visit to Ottawa is that Canada will now confidently go forward in promising more military aid to this regime in Kiev, and also financial assistance, so-called assistance that will come with all kinds of strings attached. I think Canadians have to become aware of what kind of regime that Canada is financing, that Canada is now providing, has already been providing military equipment to, and will do so increasingly. This is the first government in Europe since World War II with fascist parties in the government. And I don't mean in the parliament, I mean appointed to the ministers of the government. So this is what we're dealing with. And I'm afraid the Canadians have been so kind of bamboozled by all of the anti-Russia propaganda that they're missing the big picture, which is that, you know, we have this is an, let's call it what it is, an extremist government in Ukraine, and yet the Canadian government is sort of comfortably backing it without too much awareness or opposition to this going on either in the Canadian parliament or in civil society. So we really need to wake up to this reality. We've got a serious responsibility to oppose the austerity and war course of this Ukrainian government, which is harmful not just for the people in eastern Ukraine, but for people throughout the country.
Well, when listening to the radio broadcasts on the CBC and I suppose in other places too, we're reminded that there's a large Ukrainian population in Canada, or relatively large, and it's got long and deep roots here in the country. But it's always assumed that that support for this coup government is granted by these expatriates. Is that the case? Do expat Ukrainians and second, third, fourth, fifth generation Canadian Ukrainians, do they support unconditionally this coup government of Poroshenko?
Well, I think what we've seen, there's two things that have gone on in Ukraine in the last 25 years since independence. Let's remember, Ukraine has been an independent country now for 23 years. It's no longer a kind of within the umbrella or the framework of the Soviet Union. So unfortunately, during that time, we've seen an ascendance of right-wing nationalism over left-wing nationalism. And I think that's very unfortunate, because really the locus or the focus of the source of Ukraine's oppression as a country, and I consider it to be still today a country that is oppressed as a nation, that doesn't have the full status of nationhood, its language, its culture is still facing difficulty. But the source of that oppression and the difficulties that Ukraine continues to face in this regard in becoming, you know, what we can call a fully fledged country with a clear national mission and a strong and vibrant culture and language, it's not Russia anymore or what used to be the Soviet Union. It's increasingly, first of all, these billionaire oligarchs who run and control Ukraine, who've really run the country into the ground over the last 25 years, and now it's increasingly Western Europe and North America. We've seen this through the course of this war. This war that's gone on for the last 5 months has profoundly divided the country, unlike anything that we've seen in 70 years. So I don't, you know, I think the majority of Ukrainian people are still kind of reeling from all this, and there's that reflex reaction against Russia, which of course has a lot of historical reasons. Russia was an oppressor of Ukraine for, well, almost several centuries, you could say, but, you know, the world has changed in the last 25 years, and Russia is not the domineering power over Ukraine that the Soviet Union was prior to that. Ukraine's economic relations are increasing with the capitalist world. So, you know, I don't think that the politics of Ukrainian nationalism have caught up to that, and so unfortunately, that, you know, it tends to be the domineering influence there. It tends to be right-wing nationalism, even going over to fascism. So there's a huge political debate and struggle to be had now in Ukraine over the future course of the country to make a break with this right-wing nationalism and embrace the same kind of movements against austerity and for social justice that we're seeing, for example, in Scotland today. In this whole referendum move in Scotland, independence move in Scotland, is, you know, profoundly underlaid by sentiments of being against austerity, being against the kind of politics that Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair and other British governments need. And that's, you know, that's the way that the people of Ukraine need to catch and, you know, to make a break with these sort of, you know, what I think are quite false ideas of what the source of the problems today economically and socially are in Ukraine.
Well, and it's even, you know, Quebec has even been intoned in this country to sort of put an extra scare into people as well, at least as far as separation goes, that vis-a-vis Scotland. Well, we're fast running out of time, Roger, but we got to get to the MH17, the plane that disappeared from the media almost as completely as its predecessor, Malaysian Airlines, disappeared into places unknown over the seas a few months ago. I mentioned the ceasefire talks going on, and one of the conditions from the Kiev government was that all the people involved in downing the MH17 would not get amnesties that were promised to others. Of course, that takes it for granted that they were responsible for the MH17, which has not been ascertained. In fact, the facts seem to point at Kiev when it comes to who shot it down, although we don't know why. In the last minute or so we've got, Roger, can you give us a brief reminder of what MH17 is, what happened to it, and why what Kiev says today is a little ironic?
Sure, this was the Malaysian Airlines flight that crashed. I'll say that it crashed on July 17th. The main thing about this event that, you know, one really has to conclude looking back almost 2 months now is just how much an impartial and independent investigation was prevented, you could say, or certainly obstructed by just the intense anti-Russia propaganda that followed the downing. As you said, the either Russia or the pro-autonomy fighters in eastern Ukraine were assumed to be responsible. There's no proof of that. But what all of that did was it made it difficult to actually carry out an impartial investigation. The Dutch investigative team that's responsible for the formal investigation issued its initial report last week, and I'm afraid to say it was not an impressive report. Let's put it politely, as far as indicating exactly what the train of events would have been that day. I don't know if we'll ever get the truth of this. Certainly, what the evidence to date suggests from what we saw in news reports in the days following, even what this initial report by the Dutch team says, is that something up there in the sky shot down a plane, and it wasn't a missile. Now, you know, we need a comprehensive investigation in order to determine if that was exactly what it was, and, you know, so far we're not getting it. You know, I'll give you a quick example. The UN Security Council met on July 21st, and remember, this was in the time and in the framework of the total denunciation or blame for Russia or for the autonomy rebel fighters for bringing down the plane. And so there was a resolution passed at the Security Council saying there should be a complete ceasefire in the region in which the plane came down so an investigation could take place. Kiev never respected the ceasefire. And if you look at the several articles I wrote on the topic, you know, several of the mainstream journalists said it wasn't the rebels that were preventing investigators from getting onto the crash site and freely carrying out their investigation. It was for day after day after day, it was the Kiev regime. So, you know, that alone, the fact that, you know, the fact that Kiev sort of violated the ceasefire that the Security Council had ordered in the region right away, I think says a great deal. So, We'll see. I mean, of course, there are many, many conspiracy theories that are out there over this, and maybe I shouldn't even say that. I mean, there's a legitimate concern that everybody has to get to the truth, so we'll see.
Well, yeah, Roger. I mean, and it's not a conspiracy theory when it's everybody, when that's all that's left.